It is 6 o'clock, and it's also the first Thursday of the month, and that means that it is time once again for the monthly edition of the Post-Prison Education Program. And with that, take it away, Catherine.
Our special guest today is Celicia Hudson. She has been at Post-Prison Education Program since March of this year and is the Applicant and Student Services Coordinator. And also Ari Khan, President of the Post-Prison Education Program, is here too. So first off, Celicia, would you like to talk about how you heard about Post-Prison Education Program and how you got involved specifically?
I heard about Post-Prison Education Program in 2013 while I was serving a prison sentence at Mission Creek Correction Center for Women. I stumbled across the application for the program, filled it out, sent it in, and when I was released, I never followed up with it. And then I returned to prison in 2016, and while I was at Mission Creek Correction Center for Women also, I ran into a lady that was in the TC program with me, and she had just had a scholarship committee interview with Ari downstairs in the visiting booth, and she came back and said she was accepted for the scholarship committee, and she was going to Evergreen College. And so that prompted me to really reach out to them and follow up with them, and so a female that was in Mission Creek with me released, and she started working at post-prison doing work study. And she came back in to the prison for a resource fair. And it was someone that I really connected with inside of prison. And so to see someone get out of prison and to see that they were doing good and coming back inside the prison gave me motivation to really reach out to them. Mm-hmm. And so I would call the office multiple times and just check in throughout my prison stay. And as soon as I got to work release, I put in a pass to come down there to the office because I remember getting a letter in the mail saying, like, this is your new family, a family that, you know, sometimes you might not be able to stand, but, you know, like, we're there for you. And so I went down there, and I just really connected. I would come down there on Saturdays and sit in the office on the computer and not talk, but I got really close with I call him my mentor, Truth, and so he seen something in me that I didn't see in myself, and so that's how I heard about the program.
So what did Truth specifically see in you? Did you guys talk about that?
Honestly, I don't know. He went to school. He has a background working with youth on his tribe land, and I remember telling him, expressing my desire to work with at-risk youth and work in the chemical dependency field, and he gave me one of his books. It was Uppers, Downers, and All-Arounders, and I still have that book at my dad's house. But when I got my license, when I got out, you know, I feel like Truth was more excited for the things that I was accomplishing, and he would send emails to everybody in the office. And when I got my job at graduated Fair Start and I got my job at BJ's, I remember coming to the office and sitting on the couch with Truth for a couple hours, and we printed off the menu for BJ's Restaurant Brew House, and it was like 20 pages long, and we sat there and we went through the menu, and like, he was just really supportive of me, you know, and he just believed in me more than I could believe in myself at the time, and, you know, like, seeing things from a different view.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. Do you want to talk more about your role specifically at Post-Prison Education Program and the process that you go through with applications?
Yeah, I can do that. So I originally reached out to Ari as soon as I got to work release this time, and I was just checking in with him, you know, because I'll give you a little bit of background on that. Is after I was working with Truth, he ended up passing away. And it triggered my mom that passed away. And so I went into isolation and ended up relapsing. And during that time, Post-Prison Education reached out to me. I have multiple emails from Ari, from Keith Whiteman, reaching out to me like, hey, let's reel you back in, you know, working with my DOC officer. And their main goal was to get me reeled back in before I caught new charges. And I remember getting an email like, we'll meet you at Starbucks in Tacoma. We'll meet you at the office. We'll meet you wherever you're at. We'll come to you, you know. And at first, I ignored the emails, and I didn't respond to them until Ari's like, real talk, this is, I know what's going on, you know. And so at that time, I responded. I didn't want to just ignore them, you know. And so I don't know. They were really there for me, you know, when they didn't turn their back on me when I needed them most, you know. And so my job duties when I called Ari was, hey, I was just coming down to check in with him, you know, and I said, can you hire me on at the office? Just I'll do anything, you know, and he said, okay, I'll hire you on answering phones. And I believe part of that was because Keith always said that the students that stick around the office are the ones that succeed, you know, and so I jumped right in and I learned everything and I asked questions. And now my job title is the applicant and student service coordinator. And my what I do is I answer incoming calls from all the institutions in Washington. I help students fill out FAFSA. I help them get in contact with colleges. I help them get their official transcripts sent to the college that they're interested in going to. I help them look online, and I'm basically their computer because they don't have access to it. And so I go online and I look up different courses, different programs that they're interested in, scholarships. I print off papers, I send them to them, and like, hey, these are all the scholarships that are available at your college. You know, go through, look at the scholarships, highlight which ones you think are that will fit you, call me back, and we'll go online and apply for them. And so that's what I do, is just really work closely with the students while they're incarcerated to help them with that transition from prison into the college to make it as smooth as possible, because it can be intimidating. It was intimidating for me. So
what would you say is the best part and most challenging part of your role?
I think the best part of my role is to be able to work with students who have never gone to college, that they don't know that opportunities are out there. They don't know what's out there. And they're, you know, at first they're intimidated, but to be able to walk students through that process and see them start to see something and to be able to realize that there is opportunities out there for us, that the world hasn't given up on us, you know, and that by furthering our education, we're going to go far and no one can stop us.
Does that motivate you the most with your role?
Yeah, just to be able to, or like there's a situation where a student called in and the first process is starting a Gmail account so that we can get their FAFSA filled out. And the student had never had an email account ever. And just to hear that was heartbreaking, you know, and to be able to help them do this, it's rewarding. One of the most difficult parts of my position, I would have to say, is working very closely with the student throughout their incarceration. And when it comes time for them to release, going through their application and the admission criteria, and to realize that they don't meet the criteria for our scholarships because of lack of funding. And so it's heartbreaking to have to tell so many people that they don't qualify for our scholarships because we don't have enough funding for it.
Are there certain applications that hurt you more than others? Just the most heartbreaking, what would you, I mean, do you have any examples of some applicants that just qualifications?
I mean, right now we're working with a student who comes from a family of addiction, and that's what he was grown into or born into. Mm-hmm. And he has done a county origin change to come to Seattle. And it all started from a guy in prison talking about the Divers Institute. And he's come all the way to Seattle, did a county origin change, and he wants to go to the Divers Institute. And the only thing I think he's got it figured out now. But at one point when he first got here, it was a matter of $1,500 stopping him from being able to fulfill his dream. But I think that's handled now.
What do you think is the biggest problem of how people get into this, you know, mess of being incarcerated and falling victim to just needing these
sources? So I think a lot of it has to do with me personally is being born into it. There comes a time where it's all you know. You're raised around it. It's hard to get out of, and it's easier to just keep doing the same thing that you're used to doing when you don't have the supportive people around you to show you anything different. And you tend to lose in your addiction or in the criminal life, you tend to lose your identity. And so you become the drug dealer or the thief or this and that, you know? And so it's hard to rebuild your identity when that's all you know.
At that time, though, what motivates you to get out of there? Or do you have like a voice in your head telling you that you just have to do something?
I mean, for me personally, before I got arrested this last time, I remember telling a friend of mine, like, this is all I know. I'm going to end up dead. Mm-hmm. I'm not going back to prison. And I think I'm grateful that I got arrested because it was able to clear my mind. Because when you're in that state, the only thing that's talking is your drug. You're not thinking straight. You're not reasoning. And so for me, going to prison saved my life. And then for me, I think a lot of people, it's the people that you surround yourself around, getting out and getting connected with organizations, getting out and getting connected with people who believe in you and who want to see you succeed plays a major part in it.
What do you think are the most significant resources that you believe are just crucial to this program and that you would have, I mean, that you needed the most when getting out?
I would say just, I mean, we have students that come into the office who aren't eligible for the scholarship, but they talk about how just being in the office is rewarding. You are surrounded around other people who are striving for the same goals that you are. You are surrounded around people. Like when I applied for scholarships, I had multiple people in the office help me write my scholarship essays. I had people read over my stuff. And so it's just building a sense of community in the office is a major part in just being there. I've reached out to other places, though, like the Goodwill Training Center. I have a reentry lady there, Cammy, who I work with. And so it's just, and she's helped me with clothing. And, you know, and like I have a guy coming into the office tomorrow who's coming from work release, who's coming to check out our clothing closet because there are a lack of resources out there. And so I try to network and get whatever resources we can available for former people coming out of prison.
True. So do you want to also talk about more about the work release program specifically and how that works? Do you just apply the program or is everyone chosen or how does that? Because not a lot of people know about that, that in prison you can be hired even though you're currently in prison. A lot of people think that, you know, when you're coming out of prison, that's when you have the opportunity to be hired. But
so the way the work release program works is you are eligible for work release the last 6 months of your sentence. And not everyone gets to go. You have to be like minimum security or certain crimes don't allow you to go. Or like if you're a risk to escape, you won't go. You know, I was blessed with the opportunity to go multiple times. And I don't know if that's because I had good standing with the work release, but there are people who don't get to go. But so it's just a matter of working with your counselor inside the prison, targeting you to the work release that you want to go to and waiting for a bed to come open.
Okay.
They're only statewide. There are only 600 beds in the whole state of Washington for work release. They just increased it to 800. So when the 200 new beds come online, I don't know how fast that'll be.
Is that through funding specifically?
Yeah, I think it's. Okay.
How do they make room for those 200 beds?
Well,
you know?
I mean, the Department of Corrections has to buy those beds, right? And they have to pay for those facilities, and that costs money. So, like almost everything else in this effed up mess that we're in, it goes back to the legislature, and them being willing to appropriate money for darn near everything other than prisoners and former prisoners. But you have 700 men and women coming out of Washington's prisons every month, 8,400 a year. And right now, and for quite a while, you've had 600 beds. So, and again, just now up to 800.
Yeah, and then they get dumped on the streets in their own county and they don't know what to do, you know?
Well, that's something
exactly.
I think Shalisha was asking me about. There's a guy in Olympia. Is that who you were thinking of?
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the worst problems. Exactly.
Yeah. I want to go back to something.
Yeah, of course.
This guy that Shalisha didn't name, and I'm not going to name the guy that he's still a prisoner. He's in a work release center, and he starts Divers Institute this month. But you were asking how do people get into end up
yeah,
in prison.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, like I said, don't know that that exists.
Well, we're not talking about work release, but how people end up in prison.
Oh, okay.
Shalisha worked with Woodland Park Zoo to get us at this nonprofit event just Tuesday of this week, just a couple of days ago, and then worked with the Department of Corrections to get two prisoners out there with us tabling, explaining to the public what we do and how we do it.
Right.
And this guy was one of them. And because the guy that introduced him to us or told him about us maybe a couple of years ago, is one of our recidivists, a guy who went through Divers Institute and county of origin problems, sent him back to Clark County, where, or Tri-Cities, where he knew all the wrong people, and ended up back in the mess with drugs and everything. And I asked this guy at the zoo Tuesday, I'm like, I asked him about family and community ties, and he started talking about his mother and his father and his sister, and it kind of blew me away, but it didn't surprise me, because it's all what Shalisha said. It's all drugs and addiction, and you're raised up in it. And so I asked him, he was in the office yesterday, to turn in some paperwork and sign some stuff for Divers Institute with Shalisha, mm-hmm. and I asked him to write down what he told me at the zoo, and so I'm going to just read it. But he says, look, like, growing up, my mom was addicted to meth, and my dad was an alcoholic. My oldest sister is schizophrenic due to alcohol and drug use, and my other sister is addicted to heroin. So, you know, yeah. He says, we all love and support each other, but are torn apart from drugs and alcohol. He said, I started using meth at the age of 18, and since then I've acquired 9 felony convictions, and is just now finishing up his second prison. And that's, you know, when I heard that, and I hear it all the time, I'm like, that's every man's story, that's every woman's story. Everybody, Mike, that you've met through this program, in prison, out of prison, they're introduced by family and friends, usually way earlier than 18, at 6 years old, 8 years old, to drugs. And then you, I always say, you know, at the point, you know, if you're 8-10 years old and you're introduced to meth or heroin,
you don't have a choice.
Or crack, you can kiss your butt goodbye, yeah. Because then you're locked up in addiction, and your future is sort of written. But when you ask Shalisha about how people get caught up in this, it's not like a 6, 8, 10 year old kid deciding to be a malicious criminal.
No,
it's they're introduced into drugs and addiction, and maybe they've been born with mental illness. And everywhere they look, there's mental illness and addiction.
Exactly.
And so that's what's with this guy. And you know, a little off topic, his task now is to, and it's sad, is to mm-hmm. stay away from his family.
Exactly. They tell you to, you know, never leave your family. Yeah. But if it's not helping you, why are you supposed to go back?
You can't go back to your county of origin, which is Shelton.
But it's even worse, because when you're out of there, you almost like, you don't have your community, but it's also hurting you. So it's better off to just be starting off fresh, you know. Yeah,
you've got to find a new community. But anyway, that's an important issue to point out. And then you're going to talk about the guy, this is definitely.
So we had another student who reached out to us the day before he was released. Well, DOC reached out to us the day before he was released. It blew my mind, because he was a level 3 sex offender, ESCO 2, and was releasing homeless. They contacted us to try to get him into housing, and he didn't qualify for the housing voucher because he was not on supervision for the current cause number he was releasing out of prison from. He was on a cause number, he was on probation supervision for a previous cause number, but that disqualified him for the housing voucher. So this student was in communication with us. He was released, had a police officer pick him up, drive him out back to the county he's from, and we got in contact with someone who used to work at a post-prison education program with Keith, and we connected them together. But this student is living in a tent right now.
On the street in Olympia.
On the streets in Olympia, living in a tent. Started classes, though. He is a student at South Puget Sound Community College. Through all of these struggles, he's been able to stay focused and to get into school and stuff like that. But it's situations like that where it's multiple situations where I've had people call me and say, hey, I'm releasing, I'm getting out with $40 in a bus ticket because I am not on supervision for this cause number that I'm currently serving, but I do have supervision. And so it's like, why would you put someone on the streets like that when they are on supervision, you know? And so it's just, it's hard.
You know what? The deal with this guy, just make it really clear how bad it was like, there's five prisons in Monroe. People in Seattle tend to think that
there's just one.
There's one. There's not. There's five. You've been there, you know.
Yeah.
So, and one of the prisons you've been in, Twin Rivers Unit.
Yeah.
They have the REACH program, which is DOC-supported, prisoner-created reentry program that's pretty phenomenal, actually.
It actually surprised me how many people showed up. Yeah. People want to change and get better.
93 people when we were up there doing that presentation. And I just had a guy from Google headquarters in Palo Alto up there meeting with these guys, and he was impressed with how impressive they are. But anyway, DOC, just like Shalisha said, they call us like the day before this guy is going to release into nothingness. No housing, no nothing. And all anybody knows is that in Olympia, there are no beds for people who've been previously convicted of a sex crime. So on 24 hours notice, we're supposed to solve all that. This little podunk nonprofit, grossly underfunded, gets a call from $1.8 billion Department of Corrections asking us to solve this problem, right? And pretty much it was unsolvable. And it was so bad, it was crazy. It was so they faxed or scanned in his application the day before he's going to release. We reached out to Keith Whiteman, who worked for me for 2 years and is also a graduate of the program, and it now works for Catholic Community Services in Olympia. And Keith went to work. But what happened was somebody from the Department of Corrections drove this guy halfway to Olympia and then met the guy that would be his CCO, his probation officer, at some halfway point, and that guy took him back to Olympia. And just like Shalisha said, literally, you know, after the check-in at the DOC's office, put him out on the streets. So only his tenacity. So he's relapsed once, right? But he pulled himself out of it. He held it together. He's actually gotten he's got a very supportive probation officer, CCO. Keith Whiteman has been extraordinary. Shalisha talks to him all the time. Mm-hmm. And we coordinated with South Puget Sound to get him into school. And he's held on for months now, right? And now he's starting school, and he moves into a trailer, like within this month. Mm-hmm. And then I think we'll be okay. But that's the insanity that's going on. You know, you get hooked up into drugs and addiction. And this, you know, Shalisha mentioned he's ESCO 2, so that's a DOC designator that he's suffering serious mental illness. And all the state of Washington government has for him is to drive him to Olympia and dump his butt on the streets.
I mean, everyone kind of says that they care, but then they're like, here, push it to one person. No. They're supposed to do everything.
They don't care.
They don't care, but they'll say that. Won't do anything.
It's all fakery. It's fakery.
Yeah.
It's fakery. Jeannie Darnell at the Washington State Senate, Roger Goodman with the House of Representatives, Sonia Hallam in the governor's office, the governor himself, they all want to talk like they give a darn, like they're really trying to find solutions.
No, they're like, you know, the person should just deal with it, Shalisha, since you've been working with post-prison education program, how do you think that after, you know, you've seen what's been going on, your perspective has changed at all, or is it exactly the same since you started, or did you learn anything that you didn't think, you know?
I think it's stayed the same ever since day one, since I really stepped foot in the office. I felt a sense of belonging. I felt like the program and the people that work there really genuinely care about you and want to see you succeed. And that plays a major part because, I mean, I'm in work release right now, and I hear every day from the women in the work release that sometimes they feel like it would be better to be back in prison because it's so stressful. And feeling like the staff, like not all the staff, but some of the DLC staff, they're not there to see you succeed, but rather they're there to see you fail. And, you know, and so that's hard to hear people like with work release, it's supposed to be one step closer to freedom. And when you don't have someone there that believes in you or isn't there to support you, it's kind of heartbreaking because work release is a very vital time in our lives. We're transitioning from prisons back into the community. And when you have people there that aren't encouraging or that you feel are out to get you, it's like, what's the point? You know, like you feel like you're already destined to end up back where you just came from. But then on the other side, there are people like we have Susan.
Piccinini.
She comes into our work release a couple times a week for the GRE graduated reentry. And she takes the time to sit down with the women who are getting ready to transition from work release onto the ankle monitor. And it's just having the support of people like that.
She's DOC, by the way. Susan is DOC reentry.
She's DOC. I take a Think for Change class twice a week down at the CJC, and she seen me from a window upstairs and came all the way outside just to see how I was doing and to introduce me to someone and tell her about post-prison education program and the scholarships that I got. And so when you have people who really want to see you succeed and encourage you, it makes a big difference. And so that's what I get from post-prison is the people there, we want to see you succeed. When you fall, we're there to pick you up.
Yeah.
You know, there's a student that Ari's had me reach out to, and I was at the bus stop going back to the work release, and you know, he didn't respond to my email or anything like that. And he comes up to me, hey, you know, how are you? My name is, and I said, I know exactly who you are, you know. And as soon as I mentioned Ari in post-prison, he kind of threw his hoodie on, you know, but he's been in communication with me, you know. Randomly he'll send me an email like, hey, how are you, you know, and I'm like, we're still waiting for you to come to the office. So, you know, like, just knowing, like, even when you're out there in your addiction and you're not really thinking straight, that post-prison, they don't care. We're here for you, you know, and you can come into the office. We're going to be there to support you, and we just want to see you pull you back in before you end up going back to prison, catching new charges, or worse, end up dead, you know. And so just having people who really care, and, you know, like, we went out to UW Tacoma for the Huskies pipeline, and I invited the CCS of the work release, Stacey Fitzgerald, and her day off, she came out there, and that meant a lot to show. She showed me that, you know, she supports what I'm doing. And, you know, it was just to know that we have people who are supportive like that, and those people stand out, you know.
Going back to your mentors, Truth, I believe, is her name. His name. Mm-hmm. What phrases come to mind, like with reference to like what motivation that she gave you? Do you remember the most, you know?
No, I mean,
nothing.
No, not
I really. Mean, what has she taught you the most?
He.
Yeah. Sorry.
You didn't meet him just because he died.
Oh.
He died out of addiction, but he was the executive director of the post-prison education program.
Okay.
And,
I mean, something that stood out to me was he used to always tell me that it doesn't matter where I came from, it's where I'm going. And that's what's important, and to not dwell on the past and to just look forward.
Yeah.
So
you speak a lot about being able to help others working there, but my question is, have you gotten out of working for the program?
I think what I've gotten out of there is I've been able to build my identity. Like I stated before, is in your addiction, you lose who you are. And when you're coming fresh out of prison, like, you don't know who you are. You don't know what you like. And so I've been able to reestablished myself and to really figure out what I like, what I don't like, what I will tolerate, what I won't tolerate. I've been able to speak up for myself. I've been able to stand up for what I believe in. And in the past, I wouldn't because of the backlash or the consequences, you know. There was a situation where I tried to stand up for something I believed in, and I was punished for it, kind of. And then when I got to the work release, I tried to reach out to the organization and to file a official grievance and to try to make a better process for people that are in the county jail so that they don't have to go through what I went through. And when I originally put in my pass, I was told, why are you being petty about something like this? And for me, I don't think it was being petty. It was standing up for what I believe in and making a better process for people behind me, because I sure in heck ain't going back to jail. And so it's not going to affect me, but it will affect people. So I think that working there in working close with Ari, I've been able to really have a voice and be heard. And then I think another thing is just the confidence, having more confidence in myself that I never had before. And I think the biggest thing I've got from the program is believing in myself and seeing other people before me get scholarships. You know, like we went out to South Puget Sound Community College. You were there mm-hmm. for Jenny when she got the scholarship. Right. And so that seeing someone else actually get a scholarship pushed me to apply for scholarships. Mm-hmm. And so I was awarded a $3,000 scholarship through Seattle Colleges. And then I was nominated for a scholarship through Seattle Goodwill. And I received that too. And it's a $3,500 scholarship. So I'll be starting fall quarter at Seattle Central with $6,500 in a college fund to go to school. And I haven't even started school yet, you know?
No, that's amazing. A lot of people like don't even realize how important these resources are. And they just think money grows on trees, you know, and they don't apply to any of this. So you mentioned that, you know, you found a voice, even though, you know, you've been in tough times where people didn't listen to your voice. And I've also heard from Ari specifically that some women have been raped in prisons and, you know, they speak up, but then they never get listened to or they get punished for it. What would you say to those women? You know, how to get through that sort of tragedy.
I mean, it's not going to change if you don't do anything about it. If you just stay quiet, then it's going to keep happening to people behind you. I mean, a lot of women are scared to speak up for the consequences, or they think, oh, well, I'm going to be getting out. So, you know, but you have to think about the people who are behind you. And if you want something to stop, you have to speak up about it and you have to be brave and you have to talk about it, you know. And that's one thing I'm grateful right now is there are a lot of women right now who are willing to speak up, who are willing to go and do the proper procedure and the proper steps to be able to be heard. And that says a lot because, I mean, like I said, when I filed my grievance, I was punished for it and it kind of made me scared to talk about it. But now I'm at a point where, you know, I'm getting ready to get out of work release and it's not going to affect me, but it affects the people that are behind us. And if things are happening the way that they're happening, you need to speak up about it. You know, if there's things going on in prisons, there are proper ways, there's grievances. And I can just encourage people to speak up because nothing's going to be done if you don't speak up.
I think what was so wrong about what Shalisa's talking about is there's a really good, it's actually not a reentry program. It's a TRP and it's a Pioneer Human Services program to help people overcome addiction, and it's inside the jail in Kent. And it's an integral part of the drug court. So not everybody who's in the King County Drug Court goes through it, but if you're in, sometimes you're like, you go through TRP and successful there, we'll let you into the drug court, which happened with Jenny, by the way. And so when Shalisha went back last time, she was down in the jail in Kent, and she had gotten into the TRP program.
And I wasn't drug court. I fought to get in the program, and at first I was denied because of funding. And I fought to get in, and I was accepted into the program. And
her mother died.
No, it was my grandma this time.
Yeah, and so she missed a couple days class because she was grieving in her cell, right? And the woman who headed the program, the TRP program with Pioneer Human Services in the jail in Kent, kicked her out of the program. And it wasn't like she was irresponsibly not attending. Wow. She'd had a death in her immediate family.
And they don't care that's an
That
excuse.
Woman clearly didn't care. She kicked her out of the program and couldn't have cared less. And so what Shalisha has done since is established a grievance process that gets past that woman who was head. You know, the post-prison education program would be like a student or an applicant or a staff member trying to file a grievance against me when I'm the head of the program. There's a path now mm-hmm. where people can file grievances that goes around or above or whatever.
They didn't have that.
Yeah, to this woman. Okay. No, they didn't have it, and that's why. And
you
so
can't
she
file
she,
a complaint.
She got well. She did after she got out, but it didn't get her back into the program. But now there's a method for doing that, and that's
no,
because
that's
Shalisha pushed the envelope.
Exactly.
So it was really pretty cool.
That's amazing.
I mean, she wasn't going to shut up. She wasn't going to lay down and die. She hit work release, and she was going to have this addressed. And we, you know, we connected her with the Ombuds office and other people. And now there's a mechanism for dealing with that. So it wasn't just some like nebulous thing. It was a pretty consequential deal.
Okay. No, other than that, I was about to ask Ari, what's your most proudest moment though, after hiring Shalisha? Like what special moment that you just thought was significant, you know, watching her at any time or just seeing the work that she's done?
There's a thing called peer counseling. So, like, I used to tell Eldon Bale when he was Secretary of the DOC, it was like, white guys in suits can't tell prisoners and former prisoners anything. I can because I'm a former prisoner and I don't put a suit on very often. But in general, whether you're like Mary Lefferts Bird, who was a black assistant secretary in charge of community corrections, or you're a white guy in a suit, or you can't tell former prisoners anything. It needs to be a peer, a member of their peer group, for them to be effective, right? So a former prisoner, a prisoner. And what I wanted Shalisha to do was to be effective as a peer counselor with people coming out of prison. Yeah. And just watching her do that and take a super keen interest has been, it's like, wow, right? So, like, a couple of weeks ago, I'm like, after you get out of work release, you're going to continue to work here, right?
Yeah.
And I'm, like, scared to death to ask the question, and I'm super relieved when I got the positive answer, right? But it's like, so she's working with a lot of people, from the guy who's been on the streets in Olympia, and now, but he's starting school, moving into a trailer, to two guys we had at Woodland Park Zoo with us, both of whom are prisoners, including the guy who's going to DIT, and she's just super effective with them, and it's because she's had these experiences that she can relate to them, they can relate to her, and be effective, right? It's.
Do you want to talk about the other success stories that the post prison education has helped? You know.
Well, I mean, I. No, but I'll talk about the strategy
little
bit. So I actually put on, I don't know why, I don't know why I went back and looked at it, but this in 2013 or 14, a TV station did a movie about us and won an Emmy, which I thought was super cool. And a woman who used to be, I mean, she lives in Kelso now and she's married, but she was a student of ours, became the star of that movie, sort of. You can, it's on our Facebook page. And I think it's on my Facebook page, but you can just Google Seattle Channel post-prison education program community stories and come up with this. It's a 13-minute video, but it won an Emmy. But there's a line in there where Gina is talking about what the program does. And I think Shalisha would agree with this. It's so simple that it's infuriating that government won't adopt it. But it's just like I think what she said was, it starts at the 9:59. I went back and looked at it this morning, 9:59 into the video. She talks about it, but she says, you know, we just hold people up. We're like their concierge service, right? So they got a county of origin problem, we deal with it. The Snohomish County prosecutors are being the asses that they are. I hope that was all right. And they're after somebody for non-payment of LFOs, which they paid, whatever it is, or, you know, we've been very close for years to a guy who's back in Samoa now. You know, he was doing everything right, and Alaska picked him up on a wrongful parole violation and actually had him in the Anchorage jail, and we hired enough lawyers to defeat the Marine Corps, right, and got him back home. So what you do whatever is needed,
yeah.
and you run interference for them, and you just hold things together long enough for them to be to be able to hold things together themselves. So mm-hmm. it's like find their own footing, mm-hmm. build their own confidence, and that's all we can do. You know, like yeah. Jenny.
And sometimes it's the most simplest things, you know, that make a huge difference.
It can be, it can be super simple, and it can also be super expensive, but it can also be just having the office there. But it's like, you know, one time years ago, so Jenny Burton now we were both in the office, and this guy who's in Samoa had relapsed, and he was like close to us, like super close to me, Dawn, Jenny, I mean like family close, and his life had sort of fallen apart, and Jenny's screaming at me like, this program doesn't work, right? You know, and I mean really screaming. It's like 6 o'clock at night and he's on the evening news, and then out of that later on, we heard Gina talking about what we did that worked for her, and it's just that we hold you up, and that's all. And so the point is, that's all we can do. Mm-hmm. We can't give you the strength to overcome addiction. We can't give you the strength to overcome the trauma of losing your mom or your wife. All we can do is run interference for as long as donors and funders fund us to do so. Like, and hopefully, whether that's 1 month, 2 months, 2 years, mm-hmm. during that time when we're running interference and we're solving problems with the Department of Corrections and we're hiring lawyers or paying for treatment or whatever, you get it together on your own. So all we can do is give people the opportunity.
I mean, what happens, though, when someone's so mentally ill that they don't even know how to ask for those resources, or they don't even know what they want?
Well, we identify it. I mean, it's like you can't be like Dawn Varentis or me or Shalisha or Jenny and not see a relapse 100 million miles away. Mm-hmm. You can't be using and me not know it. I'm telling you, and I know, and I may be almost, I know it before you've admitted it, right? And everybody in the office is that way, right?
How do you know? For someone that just doesn't know anything about it, how do you know?
Because I've been around it for 15 years. It's like I've been watching people relapse and either pull their lives together or not for 15 years. I've watched people die, and I've watched people have spectacular successes. But the real... How do you know with this baby? You can jump in here anytime you want. So, like, I'm talking to Shalisha for everybody out in listener land. So, like, but you know, you have to know somebody well enough that when their communications patterns change, or you just see them doing something that seems weird based on what they used to do. So maybe it's somebody that like. Their communications pattern is they text message you 8,000 times a day. You wake up in the morning, you turn your phone on, you got 82 blue billion text messages from this person, and all of a sudden you don't get text messages. Or they email you, or they call you, or you see them in the office, and all of a sudden, but that communications pattern changes. Or they're supposed to be at work at 11 in the morning, and they start coming in at 3:30 or 4, and when they show up, they're white and pale and sweaty. You know, which is pretty blatant, or you send them a text message and they don't respond. So it's all these things that it's knowing who you're working for.
And you have to know quick too.
And then knowing them well enough that when things go south, then your antenna go up. I mean, we're in the middle of a horrible mess right now with a guy who was doing spectacularly well, mm-hmm. and now is doing spectacularly the opposite. And
but you're still working with him, right? Them.
We're sort of trying. We've laid parameters like you're going to do a budget. You're not going to blow through $13,000 this quarter again, you know. Mm-hmm. But you're going to get into family counseling, you know, this, that, and the other. But you, you just, you know, with him, my antenna were up because he was coming in late to the office, right, later than usual. And then one day I sent him a text at like 1:45, and it was a joking text. I was trying to be light, right? And so I said, like, where you is, right? So intentionally using bad language. And he didn't respond. And so like 45 minutes later, his daughter calls the office, and I wasn't even a bit surprised to see her name in the caller ID.
What do you tell their family?
Well, the family was calling to tell us. You know, they were telling us and confirming what we already knew. But they're
heartbroken too, you know. So
right.
Do you offer support?
So yeah, sure. It's just like the answer to your question is you just have to know the people you're working with well enough.
Do you think you always, through the program, do you get to know each and every single person in the program pretty well? Or is it, you know, are there some that just don't want to get close to you and just want the resources?
I mean, I know when I applied for the program, when I started coming down and sitting on the blue couch and not talking, I didn't really want to get too close to, like, I didn't really talk to Ari ever. I was kind of intimidated by him. And I just realized, like, after looking through Salesforce, that Keith Whiteman was my case manager, but I connected with Truth. And so, like, I had that relationship with him. But one thing is, when I did do my scholarship committee interview with Ari, Keith, and Truth, one of the questions they asked me are, what are signs for us to look for if you go off the deep end, you know? And so they do write those signs down. And, you know, and mine was, if I'm avoiding you, if I'm not responding to emails, if I'm not responding to text messages, then that means I probably screwed up, you know?
You're isolating yourself.
And that was exactly what it was.
Yeah, it's it amazes me how we blow through an hour here. You know, it's like 6:47 now. It's ridiculous. So
let's talk for 3 hours next time.
Well, so this is amazing woman in the community, Melody Simley, and she, in the first year, starting in 2006, the post-prison education program was the driving force behind the ombuds legislation. And at some point, frankly, I got to be scared that DSC might pull my badge, right? And we actually had a former very high executive DSC threaten Melody with cuts in funding in a program that was critical to her if she continued to support the ombuds. And so we pulled back, and then Disability Rights Washington stepped up. Melody continued the fight all along, and then finally the ombuds legislation passed. But she's in the office a lot. We talk a lot. And we were talking the other day about problems that are going on in work release, and that led to a conversation about Jeannie Darnielle, who's really a key player in all this. And I was in rehashing my conversation with Melody, I was thinking back to a meeting I had with Darnielle quite a few years ago. So Eldon Vale had resigned from the department as secretary. And was out of town, basically vacationing and deciding what he was going to do next for a month or two. And then when he came back was about when Ross Hunter, who was head of appropriations, was reaching out to Jeannie Darnielle. They were both still at the House of Representatives. And he was looking for further budget cuts from the Department of Corrections budget. And so, like, Ross didn't know enough about DOC to find the other $15 million or whatever he was looking for, so he called Darnielle. Darnielle, in reality, doesn't even know how to spell DOC. She wants the public to think she's expert, but in terms of practical, meaningful reality, I don't think Jeannie Darnielle can even spell DOC with the help of God. Because some of the things like she's done, like county of origin, proves she doesn't know what she's doing with DOC. But anyway.
Weren't you surprised originally when you saw that?
No. So then what happened was, like, then Darnell reached out to Roger Goodman, who back then was, I don't think he was, he may have been already a chair of public safety or not, but which he is now. And then Roger called me. And then I called Ellen Vail, who the former secretary of DOC. And it's like, how can we save this? How can we get this additional savings? And Eldon had an incredible plan that would have saved lives. It would have saved money. It would have reduced recidivism. It would have gotten funding to nonprofits that have proven to be effective. And so Eldon, Roger Goodman, Jeannie Darnielle, and I met in a sort of a second, third floor conference room in a hidden hallway in JLOB in Olympia at the legislative campus. And Eldon presented his plan, which I still have a copy of. It was a written plan. And at the end of the presentation, not by me, but by this guy who knows DOC inside and out, maybe better than anybody, a super highly intelligent guy, super savvy guy, Darnell got up and she said, the will's not there. The political will's not there to accomplish this thing would save lives, reduce recidivism, and save money. And she got up and turned around and walked out of the conference room. And recently, on another matter, she said the exact same thing to Melody Simley.
She just doesn't want to put in the effort.
Well, it's the will's not there. The legislature in the evening news and their God be damned quarterly newsletters that their franking privileges pay for to their constituents and in every other way they can think to do, they're telling you they care. They tell you they're working on it. But the reality is the political will isn't there to do what's necessary to save lives and save families and just do what needs to be done. It's absolutely outrageous. I'm like 700 years old at this point, and I will go to my grave believing that one of the most outrageous things I've ever encountered in all of my life is the apathy at the legislature. They just want to keep their little piddly jobs.
They want to take their sweet time and not do anything.
Job for them. They get to.
Well, because if they.
I'm going too far with this, but they're wholesalers and beer dealers and nurses and they're just members of the community 9 months of the year. But then during January through March, they get to go to these marble palaces down in Olympia and have people kowtowing to them and treating them like they're queens and kings. And they collect their $40,000-$50,000 a year, and they get their little $1,500 a month mailing privilege or whatever you want to call it. But they have job security and they have insurance, and they don't want to lose that. So they say what's necessary to keep people voting for
them. They have their
pickup
lines.
It's really sad. People, in the meantime, people are dying. Nine times out of ten, and Shalisha, nine times out of ten, somebody comes to us, I don't care how bad off they are, mentally ill, addicted, co-occurring disorders, nine times out of ten, we can work for them in a way that will lead to them being successful. One time out of ten, if we had all the budget in the world, it wouldn't matter, and somebody's going to die or go back to prison.
Are there any resources that you give, even if they're not in the program? Can you offer them anything, or do
you
have to?
It's tons of resources. But the point is that we're doing this work effectively without tools provided by the government, without assistance from the government. Because
you know it works. Yours works.
Because we know it works, but the failures and the miserable numbers, legislature, they don't give a damn. And in that Emmy award winning thing, I talked about that.
Yeah.
And so that's the big sad thing. So I'm gonna shut up for the next 5 minutes, you and Shalisha take it away.
Okay. Before the show ends, though, Shalisha, you've reached out to multiple organizations and businesses to build community partnerships. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what impact they have with the program?
Yeah, I can do that. So I reached out to the Woodland Park Zoo, and I was contacted back, and they donated 100 tickets to post-prison education program. And so I made a flyer, and I posted on our Facebook page letting any graduate students, applicants of our program know that we have free tickets for their family and for themselves to be able to go to the zoo. I also reached out to the Seattle Aquarium and built a community partnership with them, and they donated 50 tickets, and I can continue the partnership and request more tickets to them. And so I've been able to give students and graduates of our program tickets for them and their families to be able to go and enjoy that. And then I also reached out to the Pacific Science Center, and there was a lady there that was very helpful. Typically, they work with youth, but she was willing to work a program for us specifically. And so I'm putting together a twilight hike, and it's going to be after I get out of work release. And so in August, maybe September, and it's where we're going to go together as a group and meet at the Pacific Science Center and do an exhibit there and then go and take a twilight hike. And so I've been able to build those partnerships with those three organizations. And I think I reached out to those programs because for me personally, like in my addiction, I isolate myself from my family because I don't want them to see me like that. And it's not that I don't want to be around them. I'm embarrassed or I'm ashamed. And so I stay away from them. And so being able to provide families with tickets, it allows us to reconnect coming out of prison, to be able to rebuild those relationships. Some families, there's been bridges that were burnt. And so being able to meet on a common ground and to be able to spend quality time with your family means a lot. I was able to go my first weekend out with my family on Sunday. I went to the zoo with, there was about 9 of us, and we were there for 4 hours just running around, looking at everything. I got to spend 4 hours with my 17-year-old son, and I haven't seen him since I got locked up. And so it just builds that sense of family, you know, and to kind of try to find your way back into your family. And it's just, it's really helpful. And with the organizations, the community partnerships that I reached out to, you know, we, like Ari was saying, we went out to the Woodland Park Zoo on Tuesday, and we did a resource fair. And you know, I want to thank Ari and Max and Tristan both for coming out there because they made it possible, you know, because I think I wouldn't have done too good there by myself.
Yeah, you would have.
You know, but it was just, it was nice, you know, and we're planning on going back out there again. It's the Zoo for All on July 30th. And, you know, it's just nice being able to get out into the community and, you know, make people aware of what our program is about and the support that we provide, because a lot of people, you know, came up to the table and they had no idea. And it was kind of cool to be able to sit there and tell them, like, you know, this is Max and he's getting ready to start at DIT, you know, and this is Tristan and he's getting ready to go to UW for the Foster School of Business, you know, and wow. I'm getting ready to start at Seattle Central for to get my associates in human and service, you know. And so it's just nice to be able to show people, like, this is, you know, we have a past, but we're moving forward and this is what we're doing, and to, you know, really get our name out there and to show people that there are programs that help people. And so
do you have any other projects that you would like to work on?
I'm working, well, once I'm out of work release, you know, I am going to push Ari into going back into prisons more, just because, like, doing quarterly presentations more, just because that's, I like being able to go in and provide hope for people, because I mean, it's one thing to hear stories, but it's another when you see real life people come in and tell their story and, like, what they've gone through, you know, because I've been to prison 5 times, and it's just, it's nice to hear people come in and talk about that there is opportunities out here. There is a life, you know, and to really grab onto it. And so just really going into the prisons, and whether we work with them or not, just sparking that little light in someone's head will maybe help their future.
Exactly. Okay, well, Mike, do you want to end the show?
Tell people where
to get more info. Oh, you can get more information about post-prison education programs through their website directly at www.postprisoneducation.org.
No, postprisonedu.org. Or on Facebook, just on the search line, put in post-prison education program, or from the website, sign up for the listserv, and we send out a quarterly newsletter, and sometimes we send it out a little less frequently and sometimes a little more frequently.
Or just email Ari Kahn
directly. Or just Ari.Kahn at postprisoneducation postprisonedu.org, or write Shalisha, shalisha.hudson@postprisonedu.org.